He appears every Sunday on the NFL on CBS. He's host of Be More Opinionated podcast and the man who will forever yes. be known as the first guest on the CBS Sports Network, Rome Simulcast, JLC. Jason, what's up?
You should list that first, I think. I think career accomplishments. I think that should come first.
I did not in any way want
to
disrespect
shift that
you.
Order.
If it's okay with you, I'm going to take you up on that.
Okay, from here on
by
out.
By the way, as impressed as I am with your life and your resume, that's the most important thing to me. First ever guest. Likewise.
They'll never take that away from us.
They cannot. Over my dead body, man. That's a reason to go now.
That's right.
All right, so you made the point that when it comes to the Patriots dynasty, outside of Belichick and Brady, there has not been a lot of roster continuity, right?
Yeah.
So when you look back at how much this team has changed and evolved from the time when they were a physical running team with a great defense to where they are right now, where they don't have much of a defense, to Randy Moss, to Gronk, what kind of thoughts do you have when you look at that evolution?
I think it just speaks to the greatness of Bill Belichick, and it speaks to his ability to coach any position, to coach any scenario, to coach any type of athlete, to convert defensive backs to wide receivers, convert quarterbacks to wide receivers, convert linebackers to pass-catching fullbacks, to do whatever needs to be done to maximize the assets available to them vis-a-vis the warts and the deficits and the holes on that other roster, and it can be things changing from a macro level from season to season, like power running team, then the two tight ends, then the deep threat, changing from vertical to horizontal, or it could just be shape shifting in the moment. For this half of football, we need to go and do some stuff we haven't worked on since the first week of training camp in July, but I'm going to expect everybody to be able to call back on that and now put it to use. And there's no substitute for intellect, I guess is what I'm saying. He likes smart players. He is super smart. He demands a lot of out of them, and he can figure out pretty early on who can do what and what can I do with them to win. And it's like he's playing chess and other people are playing checkers.
Well, and being smart helps. You have to add that, but it's not the difference between being a really effective player and not. Like, how do they do this? Like, look at Brady. Outside of, say, Randy Moss and Gronk, it's not like he's throwing to a bunch of Hall of Famers. If anything, it's a bunch of seventh rounders. How in the world has Brady, and by extension Belichick, had the success that they've had throwing the ball to the guys they throw it to?
It's astonishing. And I think you have to lump Josh McDaniels in there as well. Tom Brady is obviously incredible. He's the GOAT. He's the greatest football player I've ever seen. I think he'll go down as the greatest football player of all time. But the guy helping pull the strings and the guy knowing what pieces to put where and the guy developing the offense and creating what they need to do that week to win, I think there's a lot of brain power and continuity in that as well, and the trust that these three men have in each other to be able to go at each other's throats sometime, to challenge each other in a way that probably others would shrink from, but they understand as part of their dynamic, and to bring the best out of them. It's amazing. I mean, I remember sitting running the numbers before last year's Super Bowl. Oh, who are the 10 guys who caught the most balls from Tom Brady? Like, Ben Watson was still on that list. You know what I mean? Like,
wow.
David Givens and David Patton didn't make the top 10, but, like, they were in the top 15. Kevin Falk was still fifth. He's throwing to Edelman and Welker, guys nobody else wanted. He's throwing to third down
backs.
Where
was Troy Brown?
he was in the top 10, I believe. I mean, like, Brandon Lloyd was, like, 20th. I mean, Brandon Lloyd was there for, like, a minute.
Right.
I mean, like, Dante Stallworth was, like, in the top 20. I mean, and then, you look at Peyton Manning, and it's Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne and Edgerrin James and, Marshall Faulk. It's a little bit different. I think that they hold themselves to such a high level, what they're willing to let slide versus what other organizations are willing to let slide, or who makes the cut with them. If you make the cut with them, they see something in you that they're going to, again, I'll go back to it. They're not going to ask these guys to do more than they can do. They're going to figure out the exact things they can do in that moment to help them win, and they'll feed them when they need to be fed.
Jason Lockenfora joining us on the row. Go back to what you said about McDaniels for a minute. I mean, obviously him leaving Indy at the altar and the way he did was not a good look. It was probably not a good thing, but I don't know that people really thought that would ultimately hinder him from getting another job. There were some really good jobs that opened up that went to some really young coaches with high side potential. Why is McDaniels, why did he not get any of those?
They'd
wait, right, if they thought he was worth it.
Yes, they would. They're waiting for Flores. They're waiting for Zach Taylor. I think there was really only two that were going to appeal to him. Cleveland and Green Bay. Green Bay, if you look at the history of Green Bay, from the moment Vince Lombardi walked in that building, only twice in the history of that organization have they hired a quote-unquote retread, a guy who's been a head coach somewhere else. They don't do it. The last time was Ray Rhodes in 99. That was a one-and-done. The only time before that was Forrest Gregg, who was a Hall of Fame player and a Hall of Fame offensive line coach for them before he went and coached the Bengals and I think the Browns. So it never really fit their model. They ended up hiring LaFleur, somebody incredibly malleable, you know, younger, never done it before, who they can bleed into their culture. Josh has a lot of that Patriots way already in him. The other one he would have taken if they offered to him was Cleveland. Twice he said to Jimmy Haslam, no thanks, I don't want to interview for your job. Now Jimmy Haslam is no longer sort of the broken down person in the corner. He's now the best looking girl at the bar, right? Now everybody wants his job. Well, you know what, Josh? We're not coming to you this time, buddy. I think it was a personal dynamic there where Jimmy Haslam felt like I was spurned by him twice before when I needed him to help build me up. Now that I'm on the cusp, I'm not going down that well.
If Aaron Rodgers had gone to management and said, I want Josh McDaniels, would he be the coach there?
I'm still not sure that would have carried the day at the end of the day. I think when you look at what they did there, and it's Mark Murphy really very much, he's the owner in every way, shape, and form now. He is flexing his muscles and exerting his ability to pull the strings in the same way an owner would, except he doesn't have, you know, he didn't have to pay, you know, $2.5 billion for the team or anything like that. But he's putting a model together that he thinks works for him, and personalities and people at parts of their career arcs are very similar in who he's putting around him. It's young, ascending people who they think they can mold into a cohesive unit where, I guess, the collective is more important than any individual. I never got the sense they were going big. I think their feeling is, we're paying this quarterback $36 million a year. We don't need to pay a coach $10 million to run him, right? We should be able to get a guy for five. This quarterback's so good, and win that way. They're going to pay Mike McCarthy $9 million to watch games on his couch this year. I don't think they were going in the deep end of the pool.
Jason Lockenfora joining me on Radio Row. Now, you had a great piece, I thought, a great piece on CBSSports.com last week about gambling in the NFL. The league has been very careful. It's been very cautious about embracing sports gambling. But based on your reporting, how interested is the league and the teams in gambling, and what steps have they taken to move in that direction?
The owners are incredibly interested, and I've had numerous people who've worked on this in the league office tell me that they see gambling as the potentially second biggest revenue stream league-wide, behind only the TV contracts. And we already know there's billions per year tied up in that. Well, the people are throwing the B word around in regards to what all the ancillary gambling revenue could be at a team level and a league level once sort of the shackles are off and we're full bore and there's an official gambling house of the NFL, and the NFL, whether they sell next-gen stats to somebody else to use for gambling purposes or to set lines or to for fantasy football or whatever, there is a new horizon out there, and these owners have dollar signs in their eyes, and they're meeting every Friday, having conference calls with the league internal people, figuring out when the technology is right, when we feel like the real-time stats are airtight, right? We can't say Justin Houston got that sack on Sunday and then come back on Tuesday and say, no, it's a half sack and some, you know, like that. The payouts are already made. And once the league's in bed with these guys, you can't have that going back. So that's, they feel like they're getting there from a technological standpoint. They're going to continue trying different models, experimenting with what they think works the best. And this spring league, the AAFL or the AAL, I get them confused.
Right.
This is the one launching right after the Super Bowl. They're going to use that as a gambling incubator, an IT technology incubator, to help them gauge which of these processes work the best, so that if it's week one, maybe it's week one where they launch full bore and start really folding gambling into the mainstream of what NFL content looks like.
I mean, what types of legal sports gambling are we talking about? During games? Are we talking about bets that are placed, like the ones that are being placed right now? Or are we talking about micro bets, not only within the game, but play to play to play?
I think all of the above. I think we could also be talking with the next-gen stats, who ran the fastest route today, who caught the highest, you know, who high-pointed the ball at its highest point, who threw a touchdown pass with the greatest velocity. I mean, whether there's a market for that as a gambling item in and of itself, or whether that information would be worth a ton of money to Ladbrokes or William Hill or somebody else to help use to set their lines or set their prop bets or whatever else, There's gold in them there hills, Jim, and they're chipping away at it.
Hey, listen, one more thought about that. I mean, you thought there was outrage over the no call in the Rams-Saints game. How about the outrage over a call that's blown like that that impacts lots and lots of bettors who are on the wrong side of a wrong call? How concerned is the NFL about that?
No, absolutely, and that's why as much as these owners on a literally weekly basis want updates on where we stand, where we're going, you know, who we're going to try out, who we would take bids on, you know, all that stuff. They know that at the end of the day, when they put their name to it, when they are involved in taking money directly from whoever their official sponsors are in the gambling realm, that everything has to look completely above board, has to be completely above board. And there's processes and vetting and things that have to go on until they get there. But that's where it's going. It's just a matter of, you know, if. Not one.
Way too much money involved. All right, before I let you go, how about a quick thought on the matchup itself? Assuming that the Patriots' offensive line keys on Aaron Donald and Ndamukong Suh, how does L.A. respond? What does their defense need to do to have success against Brady?
I wonder how much New England just keeps doing what they're doing, which is this old-school throwback football they're playing with. We're gonna keep you heavy. We're gonna make you get out of your base and adjust to us. We're going to hit you with the fullback. We're going to hit you with Dwayne Allen. We're going to hit you with Gronk. And we're going to run at your ends. We're going to run at Dante Fowler and see how he holds up. Because Joey Bosa didn't hold up that well. You know, and Dee Ford and Justin Houston, especially in the first half of that game, didn't hold up so well. And I wonder if they run away from the interior of that line, make those guys move laterally to help out the ends, to help out the outside linebackers in the run game, and try to keep them going laterally instead of collapsing the pocket. And if they come out that way and you have to adjust any manpower additionally to the box against Tom Brady, he's going to find, like Marcus Peters,
sure,
whoever, he's going to find the matchup and he's going to destroy some poor corner with the Rams. I'm fascinated by the approach Josh will take with the run game, and I think they're very happy with this throwback style they've adopted. And they've got multiple backs there who can beat you. And you go back to the Saints game, every time Alvin Kamara went wide, it was joy. 8 yards, 12 yards, 13 yards, wheel routes, little screens, flares. Those linebackers couldn't cover
him. They don't have that. The Pats don't have anybody like him, but do they need somebody like him?
Well, I think White's close enough.
Right.
I mean, you can throw the ball to James White 20 times in a Super Bowl.
For sure.
I think we've seen that before, and I don't know which linebacker is going to keep pace with him. I don't know that Mark Barron, you know, a safety/linebacker, is going to keep pace with him. You can shoot Burkhead out that way. I think it could be a keep it simple, stupid approach from the Patriots that might be very effective.
And then finally, what about Sean McVay? What do you expect to see in the matchup between the Rams' offense and the Patriots' defense?
I expect to see a lot of Todd Gurley. There has to be a lot of Todd Gurley. I think they realize that they've got to run. They're going to have to run that offense through him and then force New England to make adjustments off of it. I think he catches a ball the first play of the game. I think they force feed him early, get his confidence going, and let New England know that this isn't going to be easy for you. Again, we're talking about these teams and their offense and all the points they've scored. I think it's going to be matching wits in the run game and who makes what adjustments and where those weaknesses are. I don't think the Rams can win this game unless Todd Gurley touches the ball upwards of 30 times, honestly. Because he's going to be him in the screen game. That's a problem for the Patriots. Aren't overloaded with speed guys. I think little passes, airbacks, guys coming off the edge in space, catching little 3-4 yard passes, turning them into big gains, could be a problem for both teams.
You know, he picked a bad day to have a bad game. Luckily for him and them, it didn't matter. What do you think happened to him against the Saints? Just a bad night or something else?
I think it was a combination of factors, Jim. I think it was rust. I think it was a little bit of conditioning and all the time he missed and being... Well, he had 400 touches in the first 8 weeks. You had the wear and tear, plus the knee, plus them riding the hot hand, plus he had a crisis of confidence. I mean, I think they felt like, boy, if he can't catch a screen pass without it turning into a misadventure, and we've got this other guy that's safer, and we're just trying to kind of stay in this game, we're just going to stick with that. But we saw Sean McVay rebuild Jared Goff over an offseason from year one to year two. And not just as a football player, but sort of as a man, as an athlete, just from a confidence level. He's got 2 weeks now to get Gurley going again. He wasn't going to take, you know, time away from coaching that game to go sit there with Gurley and preach to him. But he's got 2 weeks between that game and this one. And I think he will reinstill in him, bro, there's nobody better than you. Like, we're going to feed you. You're our guy. Forget about that game. I think he'll get him mentally where he needs to be.
JLC doing JLC things. What does the rest of your day look like?
A lot of TV here on the CBS Sports Network. I I'd be lying if I said I know exactly what all the shows are called. And I haven't done them yet, but I know we're on till midnight.
I just know they can't do them without me.
No, no, I didn't say that. I'm glad. I'm happy to do my little piece
I'm
in each of them.
It.
But, yeah, we're on live here from Atlanta until midnight all week long. And, yeah, blink and you'll miss me.
My man, you are the last guy ever to complain about hard work, but I know you have a really long day, so I really appreciate you coming by.
My pleasure.
Jason, great seeing you. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Have a great week. Look for him on the NFL on CBS on Sunday, too, for a big Super Bowl day.